Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. You're probably familiar with journalist E.J. Dionne from his longtime syndicated column in The Washington Post and from his regular political analysis on NPR's All Things Considered. He's also the author of six books, including Why Americans Hate Politics, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a National Book Award nominee. His politics tend toward liberal, which makes his take on the modern history of the Republican Party all the more interesting. His new book is entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. E.J. Dionne joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
First of all, why should anyone but those who identify as Republican care about the history of the Republican Party? Why does it matter to a rank-and-file Democrat or to an independent, for example?
You know, that's a great question. And in fact, there are two sort of questions that people ask me about this book. One is that one, and the other is why should any conservative listen to a liberal suggesting what conservatives ought to do?
That was my next one.
Yeah, right. When I wrote this book, I thought I need to address that right at the beginning of the book. There are two reasons. One is, on your first question, we all progressives, moderates, socialists, have an interest in a functioning conservatism. Why? Well, first of all, conservatives have always played a constructive role in challenging those of us who are progressive when we've gone too far or when our ideas can't work. They remind us that tradition may sometimes need to be overthrown, but that tradition can also be valuable and that we have to think two, three, four times before we overthrow it. And perhaps sometimes we need to reform tradition in order to preserve it. That's a lesson I think liberals teach conservatives. And the third thing is that there are times when the left has sort of pretended that we could remold human nature, that somehow if we only had a more just society, everyone would be different. In fact, human nature is hard to remold, and if we have those pretensions, we're probably making a mistake. We should just try to make things better, and that's the task of liberals, although, according to Edmund Burke, the first conservative, that's also a job for conservatives. Now, why should conservatives care what a liberal like me thinks? And a conservative friend of mine actually made the argument better than I did in the book. He said, you know, I'm really looking forward to your book because sometimes it takes a person outside the movement who has no stake in the factional fights to take a step back and see what are we doing wrong. But I also think that the when you look at the trajectory of the country, the fact that we have a dysfunctional conservatism is bad both for conservatives and for the country itself. When you look at the obstruction of the last several years, where conservatives have not been in a position to cooperate on much of anything. Steve LaTourette, a former congressman from Ohio, told me when I was doing interviews for the book that he left Congress because we couldn't even pass a transportation bill anymore. And, you know, Steve LaTourette was a sort of solid moderate conservative who came in on the Gingrich revolution. And so I am hoping that you know, some conservatives will read my book and say, maybe we do need to take a different direction. And if it's not my book, it's the chaos of this primary season and the chaos that they have had to confront in Congress. If I could just quote one of my favorite John F. Kennedy lines is from his inaugural address, where he said, those who foolishly ride to power on the back of the tiger usually end up inside. And a lot of the politicians who courted the Tea Party, tried to use the Tea Party, are no longer there. Speaker Boehner finally packed it in because he said, I can't be effective as speaker in this climate. I think he was just tired of the fights. Kevin McCarthy was brought down. Eric Cantor was brought down. So Republicans themselves have good reason to try to rethink, and I hope I can prod that along a little bit.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is E.J. Dionne, the columnist for The Washington Post, also a longtime NPR commentator. We're talking about the history of the Republican Party now. His new book is entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and beyond. I'd like to hear from Republicans this hour and get your take from where you sit on E.J. Dionne's thesis. If you have a question or comment, if you're Republican, I want to hear from you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. How has this trajectory of conservatism within the Republican Party, EJ, how has it affected the Democratic Party and liberals?
Well, I think there is an interactive effect there. And by the way, I just want to echo your call. I'd love to sort of dialogue and argue with Republicans, too. So please feel free to call in and take issue with me or agree with me if you actually want to. There are two things that have happened. On the one hand, the Democratic Party, after three defeats in the 1980s to Reagan twice and George H.W. Bush once, realized that they needed to make some adjustments, and that was the Clinton Project. And Democrats moderated significantly on certain issues. I think in some cases that was absolutely essential. I think in other cases they gave too much ground to the right. I came across a great quotation from the left-wing intellectual Irving Howe from the Goldwater years, where he said there seems to be a rule in politics, the more housebroken the left, the more adventuresome the right. So these liberal corrections, Clintonian corrections, were both important and effective and really pushed the Republicans farther to the right. But they also ceded some ground on the left and I think helped shift the political spectrum in a different direction. So when you look at the Democratic Party now, I think two things are going on. Broadly speaking, Democrats, sort of including President Obama, and he talked about this in an interview I did with him back in 2007, accepted that there was some need to correct liberalism. And certainly he ran a fiscally responsible presidency. Now, before I hear from Republicans that he ran big deficits. Well, yes, he ran big deficits when the economy was cratering, and that's what you do when the economy is cratering. But on balance, he has pushed us back toward solvency again. And of course, Bill Clinton was fiscally responsible. I think that's a part of where the Democrats are. The other thing you're seeing is after the great crash, after a sense of irresponsibility on Wall Street, you're seeing the rise of the Bernie Sanders candidacy, but you're also seeing Hillary Clinton respond with some pretty tough actions that she proposes to take on Wall Street. So Democrats are frustrated by the obstruction, and I think that's feeding some of the Sanders insurgency. They want a loud voice of protest. And they are also trying to present a clear alternative to the right. But one of the central arguments of my book is that this polarization we're seeing in the country is asymmetric, that the Republicans have moved much farther to the right than Democrats have moved to the left, that, you know, around two-thirds of Republicans call themselves conservative. Only 35% to 40% of Democrats call themselves liberal. If you ask, do you like politicians who compromise or stick to their principles? Roughly 6 Democrats in 10 want compromisers to get things done. Only about a little over a third of Republicans want that. So I think it's central to understanding where we are, that the Republicans have veered farther to the right, and they're the people who need a correction.
Why did the Clintonian corrections that were effective at the time in terms of politics, why did that push conservatives more to the right?
Well, because Clinton occupied space traditionally taken up by moderate Republicans.
And so they did it for the contrast?
Book. I'm sorry?
They did it for the contrast?
I think they did it partly for the contrast, but I also, the core, and Clinton, by the way, at one point said we're all Eisenhower Republicans.
Right.
And indeed, a lot of Eisenhower Republicans left the Republican Party in that period. So the bigger fact is that when you look at who calls themselves Republican now, that group is much, much more conservative than Republicans were 20, 25 years ago. The party that's voting in New Hampshire today is much more conservative. The only thing that will pull Republicans back to the center tonight, perhaps, is the fact that independents, you know, undeclareds, as they call them in New Hampshire, can vote in the Republican primary. And that, by the way, gives your governor, John Kasich, a chance of doing rather well. The other thing that's happened, and the first sentence of my book is the history of contemporary American conservatism is a story of disappointment and betrayal. Mm-hmm. I go back to the Goldwater campaign in 1964, where Goldwater, whom we remember for his stance later in life as a kind of avuncular guy, and he was an attractive human being, who got impatient, actually, with how far the Republican Party became on social issues. In 1964, he was a real Tea Party candidate, and I quote his book, The Conscience of a Conservative, published in 1960, quite extensively. And if you cut out the part about the Soviet Union, which is now outdated, it is Tea Party slogans about cutting back the size of government. And the Republicans could never, Republican politicians promised to reduce the size of government substantially. They've never been able to do that because much of what government does is popular. People will criticize government in the abstract, but even Tea Partiers at or around the age of 65, and most of them are older Americans, want their Social Security and Medicare. They promise to roll back the cultural changes of the 60s, but a lot of those changes are very broadly accepted in the country. And now some of them, Donald Trump notably, are promising, in effect, to change the ethnic makeup of the country by deporting, in Trump's case, 11 million Mexican-Americans who crossed the border illegally. Well, you're not going to change the ethnic makeup of America. So conservatives are frustrated because these promises weren't kept. And I think that's why you're seeing Trump have strength. That's why you're seeing Ted Cruz win in a place like Iowa.
Goldwater was crushed in 1964. Why did moderate conservatives feel like they had to bow to that literary legacy of his? How did that happen?
Well, one of the most fun chapters to write was the chapter on Richard Nixon, because Richard Nixon is such a complicated figure. Mm-hmm. And one of the people who wrote about him really well, and whom I interviewed and also I quote his book, is Pat Buchanan, his very, very conservative speechwriter, who's showing in New Hampshire against President Bush, by the way, might prefigure Trump if Trump wins there tonight. But Pat Buchanan talked about Nixon in the 68 campaign as being utterly torn. There were really two Nixons on the inside of that campaign. On the one side was the Nixon who wanted to go to the right, who knew he needed conservative votes to win the nomination, who knew the balance of power in the Republican Party had changed, and who knew that there was backlash on race and, at the time, 60s values that could win him votes on the right end of the spectrum. On the other side, Nixon remained in many ways an Eisenhower Republican. Mm-hmm. It's Nixon who signed the laws that created the Environmental Protection Agency, Occupational Health and Safety Administration. He indexed Social Security. So Nixon was a very complex figure. And by the time he left office, conservatives blamed him for blowing it with Watergate, even though they were also angry with the media for helping sort of reveal the crimes of Watergate. And they felt that with his opening to China, his pragmatic foreign policy, and some of these domestic initiatives, he wasn't really conservative. So that began a ratchet to the right. And after Nixon, oddly, Watergate in the long run did not empower liberals. It empowered the right wing of the Republican Party, and Ronald Reagan was elected. Huh.
We are talking about the historical trajectory of the Republican Party and conservatism in the United States since 1964. My guest is E.J. Dionne. He's a columnist, of course, and author of a new book. It's entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism, From Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We'd both like to hear from Republicans today. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We want to get your take on the theme of this show today, how the Republican Party has changed since 1964. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of the Republican Party with Washington Post columnist and NPR commentator E.J. Dionne. His new book is entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and beyond. E.J., I wanted to go back to the Goldwater book, Conscience, The Conscience of a Conservative, that he wrote in 1964 when he ran for president against Lyndon Johnson. You said that even Goldwater, toward the end of his life, was uneasy with the trajectory of that legacy. Why?
Because Goldwater was had a strong libertarian streak, and he was very uneasy with the rise of the religious right. And he, I recount a fascinating moment when Bob Dole was running for president in 1996, and Dole was his main competition at that point was Pat Buchanan from his right. So Dole was trying to establish his conservative credentials. And so he went out and got Goldwater's endorsement, and Goldwater said he is a firm conservative. And then Bob Dole, God bless him, is somebody who never fully stays on message. He loves to be mischievous. And he said, you know, Barry and I here are now the liberals in the Republican Party. And Barry Goldwater said, yeah, I guess you could say we're kind of the liberals, which on the one hand destroyed the purpose of the visit to Barry Goldwater, even though Dole went on to win the nomination. But it also spoke of how far the party had moved. Even since 1964. And I tried to really delineate this, the fascinating, curious history of Goldwater in here, because it was Goldwater who set the party on the trajectory that it's on today as people are voting up in New Hampshire. It's when Goldwater became the nominee, one of the most important things that happened was that the party abandoned its historic relationship with African Americans. After all, it was the party of Lincoln. As recently as just 4 years earlier, Nixon had gotten a third of the African American vote, and Dwight Eisenhower got close to half of it. But Goldwater was opposed to the civil rights bills, not because he was a racist. He was not a racist. He had supported local civil rights bills, but he said civil rights laws interfered with states' rights and property rights. Well, that's exactly what Southern segregationists were saying. And so you had a huge realignment on that election night, and a lot of white Southern conservatives abandoned the party of Lyndon Johnson to vote for Goldwater, even as African Americans and moderates all over the country abandoned the Republican Party. And that's had a long-term effect. And if you look at the behavior of Northern moderate Republicans in suburban counties, a place like Columbus are a good example, actually. There are a lot of places in Ohio where this is true, the collar counties around Philadelphia. These were areas that were very comfortable voting for moderately conservative Republicans for many years. And over time, they slowly abandoned the Republican Party. All of that was set in motion by the Goldwater campaign, which was a conscious effort by the conservative movement and a very effectively organized effort, it should be said, to push moderates and liberals out of the party. There were a lot of liberals in the Republican Party once upon a time. And so, again, it's Goldwater who created this revolution. And it's a revolution that now has sort of steadily ratcheted right to, I think, the long term that will create long term trouble for the Republicans.
Let's take a call now. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you're a Republican, want to respond to E.J. Dionne and his thesis in his new book, Why the Right Went Wrong, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Richard in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Richard.
No, thank you, Ann. I get to talk to you on the phone. I met with you I think it was a couple of summers ago at the picnic with the Pops and all.
Sure.
Anyway, your guest, he's right on target. To understand the political system of our country, you've got to find out why the Republicans think the way they do, why the Democrats think the way they do, and the liberals and everybody else, or libertarians. Then you see what their fears and their ambitions are and how they plan to correct things if something needs correcting.
Okay.
It's sort of like we need each other, to be honest with you. It's like trying to draw a straight line with a free hand and no instruments to draw with except a pen or a pencil.
Okay. Well, that's kind of, E.J., that's sort of what you're saying is we do need each other.
Right. Oh, I appreciate the spirit of that caller, and I think one of the challenges for anybody, and I'm talking about citizens here, not just politicians, engaged in politics is how can you have your own clear moral compass? You have a strong view of how to get ahead, but not completely close your ears to correction and not view all criticism as automatically out of bounds. We need. I think it was John Gardner who once said that unloving critics and uncritical lovers don't help us, but critical lovers actually can help us a lot. They criticize out of affection and out of the sense that we're in a shared common project. And I think, this critique of the right that I am making does have some traction, I believe, in the Republican Party. At the beginning of the book, I do this partly because I am speaking to a station in Columbus, but also because he has a real shot in New Hampshire today, at least to come in second. At the beginning of the book, I quote Governor John Kasich, your governor, who really excoriated the party's moves rightward on issues ranging from Medicare and Medicaid to the flat tax. And Kasich said, what has happened to our party? What has happened to the conservative movement? And I think those are the right questions. And again, I don't want to pretend I am more liberal than John Kasich, but I admire the fact that he is raising these questions in the party, and he is suggesting that a path of pure oppositionism is not the way forward for the Republicans.
Well, you're right. He asked, what has happened to our party? What has happened to the conservative movement? Shouldn't someone like Kasich know what's happened? I mean, is this a rhetorical question on his part, do you think? Or do you think he's genuinely flummoxed by what's happened?
I think it's a combination of the two. Obviously, he is a candidate for office, and he's trying to get votes. And I think one of the ways he's trying to get votes is to appeal both to independents, moderate independents who can vote in New Hampshire, but also to Republicans who understand that a stance of pure anger toward the state of the country, even if you disagree with some or much of what President Obama has done, does not take the party forward. I mean, one question that I've been asked a lot that I think is a very fair question is, if the Republicans are in so much trouble, why have they done so well in midterm elections? Mm-hmm. Why did they control so many state houses? I'm talking about the elections of 2010 and 2014. And I think the smartest Republicans understand that while this is great for them now, because their constituency is much older than the rest of the country, and older people vote much more in midterm elections than younger people do. Mm-hmm. Also, after 2010, they benefit from a lot of gerrymandering in the states they control. But depending on older voters is not the path for the party of the future. One of the statistics I cite in the book is that when Reagan was president, only about 35 to 40% of Republicans were under 50 years old. Now over 50% of Republicans are over 50. This is an aging party. So it may help them win midterms in the short run, but it doesn't help them in presidential elections, and it is not the path to the future. A party that is largely abandoned by the young is not going to own the future.
Thanks a lot, Richard, for that call. Now we're turning to Dax in Columbus. Hi, Dax, you're on the air.
Hello. I was just wondering how Southern strategy with the Nixon campaign really started to push the conservative agenda further and further to the right, bringing in more Southern voters to not really grasp at the racism that was prevalent in the South, but the angst and the anger. I'll take my answer off.
All right, Dex.
Thanks.
Right. Well, the Southernization of the Republican Party goes hand in hand with the movement of the Republican Party to the right, because the people who abandoned the Democratic Party were Southerners, most of whom had supported segregation, had opposed civil rights. And so the balance of power in the party shifted from moderate to liberal regions of the country, my own native New England and the Midwest, to the South, which has long been the most conservative region of the country. If you look, by the way, at the map of President Obama's first election, all the Lincoln states are Obama states. When you look at what that does to what a Republican Congress does, the Congress elected in 1960 was about as Republican as the Congress elected in 2008. In other words, the Republicans were a minority with about the same number of members. In the Congress of 1960, there were only, as I recall, seven Republicans from the old Confederacy, and something well over 20. I think I want to I couldn't find the number in the book fast enough, but there are up to 30 representatives from New York and New England. When you looked at the Congress elected in 2008, there were over 60 Southerners and only a few people left from New York and New England. So the very nature of the party in Congress changed as the party became a Southern party and a more conservative party. And I try to be very careful about race in the book, because I think on the one hand, to deny that race played a role in some of the opposition to President Obama is just to be blind to what was happening. There were about 22% of counties in the country where Barack Obama ran behind John Kerry. He ran John Kerry ahead of John Kerry in almost all of the rest of the country. Those counties were a belt that went through Appalachia and down through the South, Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and also East Texas. These are places where race clearly played a role in pulling down Obama's vote. On the other hand, you can't argue that it was all race, because a lot of the same people who hated Barack Obama hated Bill Clinton. So it's a combination of ideology and race. But the racial opposition to civil rights played an essential role in the conservative coalition. I have a lot of respect and write with a lot of respect for conservatives like Bill Buckley, serious, thoughtful conservatives. But when you looked at National Review and Buckley in the 1950s and early 60s, they were opposed to civil rights. They knew that the future of conservatism rested on Southern voters opposed to civil rights. So race is very much part of this story. It's part of it in a complicated way, but it's part of it in a very clear way.
Sean in Columbus, you're on the air with E.J. Dionne. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Ann.
You bet.
My question is specifically about climate change. And I'm a Republican. I come from a Republican family. I'm actually going to be interning at the Republican convention in Cleveland this summer. Really excited about that.
Great.
But one thing I just cannot tie my head around in today's Republican Party is climate change. You think about the National Park Service was initiated under Teddy Roosevelt. We had cap and trade under George Bush I. And you just brought up earlier how the EPA was started under Nixon. So it seems to me that there's been a long tradition of conserving the environment, or at least keeping government accountable for conserving the environment. But when you listen to the front runners today, whoever it is, they're not talking like Hank Paulson, you know, somebody who believes in climate change and believes that there is some sort of moral obligation to do something about it. It's a conspiracy. It's a hoax. It's pseudoscience. And as somebody that so you talk about alienating young voters, you know, I'm 23 years old. It'll be me and my generation and my children's generation that's really going to have to deal with the effects of climate change, not the 65-year-old Republicans right now. So I'm wondering, what your guest thinks about that? What are the reasons for that? And just a short caveat, does he ever think there'll be a true independent candidate that can run for president? Thank you very much.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, Sean. E.J. Dionne.
I can't say how happy I am that Sean asked that question, mm-hmm. because I think it really goes to the heart of what I write about in the book. And first of all, as he pointed out, in terms of the rich tradition of the Republican Party in conservation and environmentalism,
right.
he is absolutely right. George H.W. Bush appointed an excellent, widely respected EPA administrator. He really did have a good record on the environment, signed a new Clean Air Act and so on. But the Republican Party shift on climate change is very abrupt and really unfortunate. As recently as 2007, 2008, John McCain was out there saying climate change is real. We have to do something about it. He introduced a quite progressive bill on climate change with former Senator Joe Lieberman. And it may not have gone quite as far as some environmentalists would have gone, but boy, would environmentalists love to just pass that McCain-Lieberman bill now. At that time, a lot of Republicans were saying, well, we don't like cap and trade because it's too complicated, but perhaps we could use a carbon tax that would be more market efficient, but would do something about climate change. Then what happened? I think there were two important forces in the Republican Party that have forced so many Republicans to abandon the very sensible position of your caller. One is obviously the power of money in politics. I quote the maverick conservative David Frum referring to the radical rich. You know, the Koch brothers are an obvious example of that, but there are others, people in the oil and gas industry. These contributors play an important role in every aspect of Republican politics, from the campaigns to the think tanks. And then you have, to quote from again, what he calls nicely the conservative entertainment complex, where he's referring to Fox News and the various talk show hosts, where it's become utterly unorthodox for the party that pioneered conservation to be an environmentalist party. And so now, if you say you believe in climate change, you are cast into the ranks of the unorthodox. And this is indeed, as the caller said, part of the party's problem with young Americans. There are plenty of middle-of-the-road young Americans who are fiscally responsible and would be open to certain arguments Republicans might make. But their stance on climate change, I might also add gay rights and gay marriage,
right,
it kind of closes the party off from an awful lot of young Americans.
My guest is E.J. Dionne. We're talking about the thesis of his new book. It's entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. As we mentioned earlier, we'd love to hear from Republicans today about what they think about their party now. Maybe they've left the party. They don't identify with the party necessarily. They go independent, but in their hearts, they always have felt like they're a Republican. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you could check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the history of the Republican Party with Washington Post columnist and NPR commentator E.J. Dionne. His new book is entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. We'd like to hear from Republicans this hour. Do you think the party went wrong? Do you think the right went wrong? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. E.J., you've argued that there was an option back in the 1950s and 60s, the path laid out by Dwight Eisenhower. We talked about it earlier in the program. What was that path and how did Republicans miss it? Was it just because of Barry Goldwater's race or what?
Well, I do write very warmly about Ike. And I think that there were two conservative alternatives that they didn't move so far to the right now that people don't even, a lot of people, particularly conservatives, don't think of Ike as a conservative anymore.
Right.
The Goldwater campaign and the conservative movement that it represented saw Ike as a sellout and insufficiently conservative. Joe Scarborough said that they looked upon him as a liberal in golf cleats. And I'm paraphrasing Joe on that. And he is one of the few conservatives, actually, who agrees with my view of Eisenhower as a solid conservative. And they just felt that Ike was not ideological enough. Why? Well, Ike was, I think, a classic sort of Burkean conservative. Burkean conservatives have, as Burke put it, a disposition to preserve and an inclination to improve. He accepted that certain changes had to happen in order to preserve the essence of the American system, so that he didn't view the New Deal as a hostile takeover of American capitalism. He viewed it as a correction that American capitalism needed to remain strong. But he was pro-business. He was he was very fiscally prudent. We ran very responsible budgets. He saw conservatism as representing prudence and balance. And a lot of people remember the one line out of his farewell address where he warned against the military-industrial complex. And he was someone who was so fiscally responsible that he applied it to the military that he had served in all his life. But it also was a beautiful plea for balance between public and private, between the long term and the short term. And this is kind of, obviously, we're not going to replicate the 50s. We're not going to replicate Eisenhower Republicans exactly. But just as we can all look back for philosophical moorings to earlier times and earlier figures, Republicans can also look back proudly to Lincoln. I think that Eisenhower's conservatism as prudence that accepts the need to move forward while broadly preserving our way of life is a very promising path that conservatives could take, and I think begin to reclaim some of the ground politically they've lost, especially among younger Americans, among African Americans and Latinos, but also to create, again, something more like a constructive partnership. To say that government, to constantly say that the whole goal is to reduce government and cut taxes, is not a conservative attitude to our government. It's a reactionary attitude. Ike gave us two big programs aimed at investing in the future. One was the interstate highway system, the biggest public works project in our history. And the other were guaranteed student loans, which helped build on the GI Bill and helped educate generations of Americans, by the way, including this one. I used the Eisenhower student loan program to go to college.
So did I.
And so, yeah. And so it's a kind of conservatism that wants to save a lot of aspects of American life, wants to preserve them, but understands that a certain amount of change is necessary if we're going to move forward.
Ibrahim in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, and Mr. Dion, thank you both for having this conversation. So last year, I ran for public office as a Republican. I am Black, a 25-year-old Muslim immigrant. And that is, I'm probably the only Republican with all those things in probably Franklin County. And so
that's
very
impressive. They have to cherish you.
Right. And I was the first to make the general election on behalf of the party. So it was historic. And I was able to bring so much into the party. Now, as the previous caller was talking about, the other millennial that was talking about the continuous alienation, I wanted to know if how the anti-Muslim rhetoric, anti-immigrant rhetoric that I am all part of, is that going to continue in the party? Because increasingly I feel isolated. And so I wanted to see if that kind of evolution and change that you've seen in the party over time, is that going to continue to be more inclusive as the world goes towards that direction?
Okay, Ibrahim, thanks. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I am as an American, not as a liberal, as an American, very also as a liberal, I guess, but primarily as an American, worried about this Islamophobia that has entered the bloodstream of a large part of the conservative movement. And it flies in the face of where President George W. Bush was. I'm very critical of President Bush in certain ways in this book, and I have been in my column, for I was a critic throughout his administration. But one thing I always admired him for, and I really lift up in this book, is the speech he gave at the Islamic Center here in Washington, D.C., days after 9/11, where he asked Americans, he almost demanded of Americans, do not hold this against our Muslim brothers and sisters who are fellow citizens, who in many cases were people who were fighting in our military. Do not hold this against them. Do not discriminate against them. They are Americans just like we are. And in this campaign, again, I disagree with him on a great many things, but I admire Jeb Bush for standing up to Donald Trump on this Islamophobia. And when you saw, I think after Bush left, the party, large parts of the party, felt freer to indulge in this. And that whole fight over the so-called mosque at Ground Zero, first it was not a mosque, it was a community center, and it wasn't at Ground Zero. It was near the World Trade Center that was knocked down. There were a few Republicans who spoke up and said, we are a country of religious liberty. We are proud of being a country of religious liberty. How can we say that a group of Americans cannot build this place in this community? And yet it took off as an issue and became so strong that some Democrats just backed away from defending it. This is a terrible thing that's happened inside the Republican Party, and it is not going to help us in the world. It only plays into the hands of those elements, those folks who are using Islam for terrible purposes, the way ISIS is. So I hope the caller, obviously he's probably way more conservative than I do. I'd like to persuade him to become more liberal. But I also hope he stays the course and fights this fight inside the Republican Party, because this isn't who we are. The First Amendment is one of our great achievements as a country. And we've had discrimination against other religious groups in the past. I have hope that just as there was a lot of discrimination against Catholics once upon a time, that faded away. I hope that happens with American Muslims. But this Islamophobia is very dangerous to us as a country.
An email from Dan in Bexley, who writes, what does EJ think of the thought that Trump and Cruz make other far-right Republicans like Rubio seem to many more palatable than they otherwise might be perceived? And I would add to that, EJ, the same goes for Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's considered conservative, all things being equal, but appears much more moderate with the lineup as it stands.
I couldn't agree more with that question. I talk in the book about how the so-called establishment in the Republican Party has had to give enormous ideological ground in order to maintain some hold. Two really smart conservative writers, Ramesh Nuru and Rich Lowry of the National Review, wrote a piece a couple of years ago called Establishment Tea, which I think perfectly captured where a lot of the establishment moved. I think when you look at the array in this campaign, I think Bush and Kasich have been somewhat more willing to stand up to certain aspects of this right than others. Kasich, and I agree, again, Kasich is way more conservative than I am, but at least he has spoken out against a kind of irrational anger and divisiveness, and Bush has spoken out against Islamophobia and this and it's one thing to argue about what our immigration laws should be, and there's a legitimate argument about immigration. But when the language sounds, sounds anti-immigrant wholesale or veers into racism, as Trump's rhetoric does, that's a real problem for the Republican Party. But I think Rubio is a fascinating case where, you know, he had that terrible moment in the debate, and I think his biggest problem in the campaign may well be that he started out as an optimist about America and was trying to run more as this moderate kind of establishment tea conservative, and has toughened his rhetoric in order to pick up votes on the Trump-Cruz side of the party. And he may end up with a lack of credibility on both sides of the party. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens tonight. But the caller's absolutely right. The whole spectrum has moved, including large parts of what is called, even though I think it's not entirely an accurate term, the establishment of the party.
Right. So, you know, you mentioned earlier Eric Cantor, you know, powerful Eric Cantor in the House, couldn't get reelected in South Carolina. How do you think someone like a Jeb Bush or a John Kasich manage, even if they do well in the New Hampshire primary?
Well, in Cantor's district over in Virginia
here, right?
I do that sort of thing all the time in Virginia near here. There are two fun facts about that. One fun fact is there are costs to gerrymandering, and one of the reasons Cantor lost is they took some Democratic areas out of his district to include more Republican areas. In those Republican areas, the Tea Party was very strong, so. Oddly, and this sometimes happens when you redraw districts, something done to strengthen Cantor actually had the effect of throwing him out of office. But it is also the case that particularly in the South, it is very hard to hold the line, even when you're as conservative as Eric Cantor was. Mm-hmm. And the issue that was used most effectively against him was immigration, where Cantor made some noises about over the years about being in favor of immigration reform. He actually sponsored some efforts by younger conservative intellectuals to kind of rethink where conservatism was. This turned out to be very dangerous to him. And, you know, I do think one of the reasons Jeb Bush has run so poorly is because a lot of conservatives in the party now regard the Bushes as far too liberal. Now, that comes as news to liberals out there, and maybe to a lot of moderates. And the same thing happened to Cantor. So even we can't necessarily take what happens tonight in New Hampshire as predictive of what's going to happen. On the one hand, if Trump wins, it means that even in a state fairly hospitable to moderates, there'll be a lot more moderates because of the independent crossover. voting in the Republican primary in New Hampshire than voted in the Iowa caucuses. If even in a state like that, if Trump wins, that tells us something. But we're going to have to test if Kasich and Bush, for example, do relatively well, that now the race moves to the South. And I think that's where if Cruz has a sort of medium showing, which is what I kind of expect, he is looking to be quite strong when the race moves south. So, yes, I think that this overall move of the party to the right will still make it difficult for Bush and Kasich. But if they do well in New Hampshire, it'll at least show that there is some resistance on the part of the electorate.
This tenor of anti-immigration that Trump has certainly exploited in his campaign and others, is this sort of a part of a cyclical xenophobia that way predates anything like a Barry Goldwater or anything like that? We've seen it surges of it over the years in the United States. Or is there something different because of this war on terrorism world that we now live in?
Well, I kind of agree with both halves of that question,
okay,
which is you're entirely right that we have gone through waves of opposition to immigration. It goes back to the late 1840s and 1850s, when large numbers of Irish immigrants poured into the nation's big cities, and something that became known as the Know Nothing Party arose and actually had a strong role in the early Republican Party, although Abraham Lincoln rejected the Know Nothings. And, you know, we had it again in the 1920s. There are moments when the number of immigrants rises to high levels, and they are at high levels now. In historical terms, the number of foreign-born in the United States is at a relative high point. You have to go back, I think, to the 1910s to find a comparable number. And so there's some pushback, and we eventually come around to sort of settling this argument. And obviously, also immigration is very sensitive to the economic circumstance. One of the paradoxes is that we have this rise of anti-immigrant feeling at a moment when net immigration to the United States from Mexico has fallen to below zero, because a lot of this was the pull of the economy. And when the economy went south with the Great Recession, immigration stopped into the country. But I also think, and here's where there is something that both parties need to learn from both the Trump insurgency and Bernie Sanders insurgency, which is a lot of people are hurting in the country, especially if you look at middle-aged, particularly men, and that includes an awful lot of middle-aged white men who vote in the Republican primaries. They have been hammered by the new economy, by the combination of globalization and technological change, the export of industrial jobs, the decline of unions. There's a lot of anger in that group that is legitimate anger at what's happened to their living standards, to the living standards of their families. And I think that if this campaign teaches the rest of the country, including the best-off Americans, nothing else, it ought to teach them that attention has to be paid to the problems of people who do work hard, who want to work hard, who want to maintain a standard of living for their families. Who are in big trouble. And when people are hurting, they are far more likely to say, why should we let more immigrants in? They are more likely to respond negatively to immigration, for example. People need to, politicians need to provide some real answers to these problems and not play on the resentments the way I think Trump is doing rather effectively.
E.J. Dionne, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
It's been a real joy to be with you. Thank you so much.
E.J. Dionne, columnist and author of a new book. It's entitled Why the Right Went Wrong, Conservatism from Goldwater to the Tea Party and Beyond. Thanks for all the calls. Thanks for the emails. And thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.